This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tenzina Vega. On Monday, tennis superstar Naomi Osaka decided to exit the French Open, which got underway this past weekend. Osaka had previously announced that she would not be participating in post-match press conferences at the tournament, citing mental health concerns. After her first round win on Sunday, French Open organizers fined Osaka $15,000 for skipping her press conference. Osaka was also warned by organizers of the four Grand Slam tennis tournaments that she risked a complete suspension from the French Open for refusing to speak with media. Following the news that she was leaving the tournament altogether, several prominent athletes expressed their support, including Steph Curry, Russell Wilson, and Serena Williams.
I feel for Naomi. I feel like I wish I could give her a hug because I know what it's like. Like I said, I've been in those positions. We have different personalities, and people are different. Not everyone is the same. I'm thick, you know, other people are thin. So everyone is different and everyone handles things differently. So, you know, you just have to let her handle it the way she wants to in the best way that she thinks she can.
But other current and former tennis pros have been more critical of Osaka's choice not to speak with the press. Osaka's announcement and the range of reactions it has received are part of a much longer history of Black athletes questioning what they really owe to predominantly white reporters. Last week, Osaka used her Instagram account to link to another notable example, running back Marshawn Lynch speaking, or rather not speaking, to reporters in 2015.
Hey, I'm just here so I don't get fined, so y'all can sit here and ask me all the questions y'all want to. I'm going to answer with the same answer, so y'all can shoot if y'all please. I'm here so I won't get fined. I'm here so I won't get fined. I'm here so I won't get fined.
For more, I'm now joined by Amira Rose Davis, Assistant Professor of History and African American Studies at Penn State and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. It's great to have you here, Amira.
Yeah, great to be back.
And also with us, Dr. Caroline Brackett, who's Assistant Dean and Associate Professor at Mercer University's College of Health Professions. She's also a licensed professional counselor. Dr. Brackett, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Amira, I want to start with you. Can you just walk us through the timeline a little bit? How do we go from Osaka's announcement last week that she was just going to not speak with the press at the French Open to her choice to actually exit the tournament entirely?
Yeah, so last week she put out a preemptive statement saying, heads up, I'm not going to do this for my own mental health. I know I'll get fined. I hope that they use the fine towards mental health initiatives and support. And that was that. The immediate response to that was swift and varied critique, suggestions that she should woman up, that this was part of, you know, her duties as an athlete. And then the one most significant response was not just the fine that she received after her first round win and she didn't do the presser, but all four slams, that's the Australian Open, the French Open, Wimbledon, and the US Open, coming together to issue a joint statement both to her and publicly that the first few lines said, we stand by her, we're going to support her mental health, et cetera, and then very quickly turned to, but just also so you know, not only will we continue to fine you, but these fines can escalate, and also you could be in danger of, we will default you from the tournament, we will remove you from the tournament. Naomi's response to that was to issue another statement via her social media to say, I don't want to be a distraction. I was trying to get ahead of it. She disclosed her own mental health concerns in more detail. She offered up that she's been battling depression and anxiety. And then she said the best thing for her to do was to withdraw completely in protection of her mental health and really kind of pushing back by refusal, by saying no at being kind of forced or kind of strong-armed by the slams into participation. And that's where we are now, where we see a number of conversations again occurring on the heels of her decision.
So Dr. Brackett, I want to come to you on this because that idea of protecting the mental health, it certainly seems to me if she said, I have a, you know, I have a sore elbow. I have a, you know, a torn muscle. I have a twisted ankle. And therefore I'm not going to compete. Then everyone would be fine with that because the protection of the physical health is considered acceptable, reasonable, and real. But that saying I have emotional or mental health that needs, you know, a little protection as well, sort of elicits this kind of pushback.
Yes, I think that it raises a bigger issue in the disparity that we see in the way people treat mental health conditions versus physical conditions. When someone is experiencing issues related to depression or anxiety, you often want them to do things that are going to alleviate symptoms and to focus on their self-care. And when a person reaches out or expresses that they're going to do that, they're experiencing some backlash. I think that it's important to recognize that if a person is saying, this is what I need to perform at my best, but also for myself, my own mental wellness, that we respect that. And as a college administrator, but also someone who worked with students with disabilities and mental health is covered under, in the United States, the Americans with Disabilities Act. And there's a process of accommodating those disabilities. And so mental health is one of those. And I think we just need to take a step back and recognize that there are times when we're putting too much pressure on people to be what we want them to be and not giving them that space to do what they need to do when it's in their best interest.
And I'll say maybe not just us and not just we, but maybe specifically media. Let's take a listen to Osaka at a Wimbledon press conference back in 2019.
When you play someone who you lost to so recently, how hard is it not to have that in your head?
It's, how hard is it not to have that in my head? Very hard. I don't know how to answer that.
Amira, listening to her respond to that question back in 2019, it seems it's pretty easy to hear kind of how difficult that is for her. I'm wondering, like, are reporters really just the most awful? I mean, and I don't mean that in a joking way, but like quite seriously, it's pretty painful to have to live your good and your bad in such a public space.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, I think there's three different things in operation here. But first off the bat, absolutely. Naomi has been talking about this and gesturing to this for a while. She's very introverted, and that is very clear. You know, leading up to this, the narratives around her being really bad on clay and was she worried about, you know, getting another first round defeat because she's bad on the surface, like certainly was really heavy on her. I think that, you know, there's some particulars around here about sports media and the role of the journalist. And, you know, you're right, you know, we're academics. Like when I get a fellowship rejection, 5 minutes later, I'm not sitting in front of, you know, people right. telling them what I did wrong and, you know, how I'm thinking about it.
And how so I think that revise and resubmit feel.
Right, exactly, exactly. And so I think that there, you know, one of the conversations that is being had, of course, is what is the function of this presser? What is required of athletes? And I think Naomi is part of a kind of growing, you know, cadre of athletes who are pushing back and saying, you know, you have access to our bodies, you have our weight, you have our height, you have our injury history, you have all these things. And then you also feel entitled to have all of our minds on your terms at, you know, when you require them. And particularly Black athletes who are pairing this with, you know, their right to protest, are pairing this with conversations about fan abuse that they are dealing with. And they're saying, hey, they're using their shifting power and their own presence on social media to push back and say this, we shouldn't have to accept this at our place of employment. We shouldn't just have to grin and bear it. We shouldn't just have to go along with it because that's what you do. And you know, may have bought a ticket to the circuits, but we don't have to be your clowns. And this is where we're drawing the line on our labor. And she's also absolutely part of that conversation because you can hear in that clip, you know, her, you know, how she's feeling about it. But you have all these other instances with Naomi where she's pushing back or trying to reframe the kind of questions she's getting. And I think that points to one of the issues. No, journalism's like, oh, they're not just the worst, but there is a particular recycling of narratives. When she says in her letter, in her statement, that she's had depression since the U.S. Open in 2018, which was, of course, her and Serena and that big hullabaloo. That gets brought up every time they play each other, every time she goes to the U.S. Open, every time, you know, she thinks about it. And this regurgitation is part of what she's pointing to.
Listen, first of all, I'm about to get a T-shirt that says, you may have bought a ticket to the circus, but I don't have to be your clown. And I'm going to wear it every day. I really appreciate that framing. And Dr. Brackett, I want to come to you on that, in part because earlier we heard in the clip Serena Williams saying, you know, people deal with things differently. I'm thick, she's thin. And I don't think she meant that as a dig, but rather just as descriptive. But I also kept thinking, yeah, she's also two decades younger. Like, I think Serena's desire to give her a hug is in part that sense of, like, she's very young still and coming through this process. Given the work that you do with young people at exactly this age, what are some of the challenges for having to manage failure or those kinds of repeated re-traumas in such a public way?
Yeah, I think that that's important to look at. And when you look at the age that she's in, she's still in that identity development stage in her life, and hearing messages from people and the media are not going to help when they're negative towards her. And that's not to say that, you know, as an athlete, that you're not going to face some criticism. But I do think that it's important, for one, you know, she's using her voice. And when she starts to use her voice, then she can control her narrative. And it's important to think about, when people are asking you questions, they're asking questions to write the story that they want to write about you. And so you do lose some of that control that you have when you're sitting in those press conferences. And I do think that it's important. You know, one of the things that she said in her statement is that she reached out to the tournament to, you know, talk to them after the tournament because of the pressure that she was feeling during the time that she was playing, but also being open to having some communication about how can we make this better for the athletes, for the fans, for the press. And I think that that's an important consideration, you know, systemically. How do you, or how do they work together? That's the tournament, the athletes, the press, to create a system that works for all. And that's not saying that you're going to give athletes a pass, but taking into consideration the person, you know, we need to have that person first language. There are people who play professional sports. And so putting the person back into what they're doing.
And that idea of person first is also, it feels to me, Amira, connected to, you know, important identities, right? So she's young, she's a star, she's well paid. She's also a Black woman, you know, barely out of being a Black girl. And it does feel to me like our, you know, our public willingness to accept no is gendered. So boys and men are much more able to be like, nope, not going to do it. But when women say no, whew, that's a whole nother kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how much of this feels intersectional, race and gendered, to you, Amira.
Bound up together. But I think that there's, you know, I think that that last point about how she indicated in her statement that she wants to work with the Slams and really underscore this moving forward is really important, because it's also her recognizing that while she is bound up in these very familiar kind of the double bind of being Black and a woman, she's also well paid. She's also at the top of the sport. And there are people on the tour who are suffering mental health concerns that can't eat a $15,000 fine. There are people who cannot afford to withdraw from a circuit. And so this is a continuation of her using her platform. But I think more importantly, you know, I heard a bit about the earlier segment, which was so important to talk about the mental health concerns of Black girls who are often overlooked, and all the ways that, like, myths of strong, superwoman, you know, Black girl magic is really creating mental health concerns, especially around depression and anxiety for Black girls and Black women. And the times where we really get to have these conversations, when Meghan Markle, you know, talks about it, when Naomi Osaka talks about it. So that visibility of this conversation bound up in being a Black woman is also a really, it's the condition of how it's received. as well as what she has to put out to the world.
Amira Rose Davis is an assistant professor of history and African-American studies at Penn State, and Dr. Caroline Brackett is an assistant dean and associate professor at Mercer University's College of Health Professions. Thank you so much to both of you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me today.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.